Hey everyone, this is Natalie. If you listened to our last episode of Revenant on the Rocks, you might have heard the exciting news that Ben is on paternity leave. So we are taking a little pause from Revenant on the Rocks while he's away for 3 months. That being said, I will still be in your ears. I am now co-hosting the Go to Market News Desk podcast. That's what you're listening to now. Similar themes where we're going to bring on marketing experts to talk about buying best practices, what's going on with marketing sales alignment, and just how can you create a better buying experience overall for your prospect and customers. So if you're interested in some of the themes we talk about in Revenant on the Rocks, this will be a great podcast to listen to. A little different of a format, but not entirely leaving your ears while we're taking a break from Revenant on the Rocks. Cheers.
Honestly, I just don't believe in this silver bullet that one size fits all. Like, every team is unique. Their problems is unique. That is why, like, we always have, like, I do it myself. We do it with product-led, whatever. Like, we have the audit, basically, to understand what the needs are. Like, I would never sign any client before actually talking to them.
No BS news about B2B go-to-market. This is GTM News Desk with me, your host, Mark Killens. And my co-host for this season...
I'm Natalie Marcatulio. I'm going to talk about what's going on with go-to-market.
What's up, Natalie? Welcome to the first official episode together.
I know. I can't believe it was first one. I felt like I was a little nervous, I'm not going to lie, but I think it went well. And I have a brand new mic, so I feel like that was a good sign. Like, I came prepared for first day of class.
The new backpack, the new mic.
It might be because my old mic broke like a few months ago and it's been on my to-do list to replace it. And this was a forcing function, but I'm going to say it was, you know, to get ready for the new.
What kind of mic did you get?
I did get a Yeti mic from Logitech or something like that. Yep. Mostly because someone recommended it to me. And there's so many options. I actually hate shopping on Amazon. I know that's like counter to most people, but there's so many options and I get so overwhelmed. So someone recommended it. It seems high quality. They even had a used option, which was sort of nice, and it seems to work, knock on wood. So that's what I want.
Decision fatigue. We're gonna kind of unpack this with Anastasia, like the behavioral science, human behavior, in segment number three today. Yeah, I definitely have decision fatigue like every single day. Well, segment number one today, I'm gonna curate this one. And then of course you have a new segment that we'll talk about in a moment. State of Interactive product demo report. You've been doing it for 3 years now?
I believe so. I think we did like an early version that was sort of a very like the beginning of it, but officially 3 years, yes.
Okay. So I've read every single report since you've been doing it. I think it feels like 3 years. The data gets more interesting as you do it. So folks, if you're listening, if you do reports, I would encourage you, unless Natalie, you think maybe I'm wrong here, but like be pretty consistent year over year with the reporting. Like don't like change it too much, right? Is that the best practice there?
I think so. I think, and just for some context, basically every year we put out this big state of report. Nothing revolutionary in B2B. I think we've seen these before. I think what your goal should be is always, or like every year you should have the same goal. Like every year, our goal is we ask our customer success team, I mean sales team, what are the most common questions you're getting about interactive demos this year? The actual content does change because it depends on what are the themes that are coming up this year. But I would keep the same structure. And like, again, what is the goal of the report every year? Yes, you can steer the content or maybe go broader or more narrow. But have a reason for doing it. Don't just have the reason be, we want to make our product look good and we're going to publish all these ROI stats.
That's a good point. Yeah, and would you call this report more like middle of the funnel? Because it is about your category in a way. Do you think it's more top of the funnel? How should people think about these reports, do you think?
So I actually think it hits every point of the funnel, which I know maybe I'm just giving the marketer it depends answer, but I'm going to give my reasoning for it. One, I think it hits top of funnel because we do a lot of promotion for it. Mark, you've been part of that promotion with our advisor network. And yeah. If nothing else, people are just suddenly seeing the word Nevatic a lot. And it's equating us with interactive demos. Like, I really helped as far as like brand authority, you know, thought leadership, whatever people want to call it now, because it was like, okay, Nevatic's putting out a big report. Even if you didn't care about interactive demos at all, at least now you know that. And there were a lot of people who, when we did early rounds of promotion, it's the early days before, like, I feel like comment gating was like such an annoying thing to do. There's a lot of like opinions about it now. Early days, we did that and was like, hey, comment if you want early access. I did message every single person. And I can't tell you how many times now someone will come inbound and sales will be like, hey, looks like you're connected with this person. And I'm like, oh, interesting. I'll go back and realize I connect with them to send them the early access. Again, this was like 2 or 3 years ago. We don't do it as much anymore. But it really did get some top of funnel and middle of funnel awareness. But obviously, it's also very bottom of funnel. The sales team uses it all the time on calls. They will literally pull it up on a call if anyone has a question and be like, hey, here's a stat from the report. And the CS team loves it. It helps answer any customer question. So I'm copying out and saying everything. You can use it for everything.
Well, I love it. And it's a good answer. It's a good answer. I'll give you that answer. That's a good answer. I'm looking at some of the key takeaways from this year's report. There's a lot of them. One of them that's interesting to me, which is related to the conversation, again, we'll have with Anastasia soon, is how you want to be like buyer first, people first in all of your go-to-market these days. There's stats around like the rise of mobile being more important. The stats around like not gating these just like, in the beginning, right? There's definitely some that have gates, but like making this accessible, making it accessible both on the device level, getting the actual interactive demo experience very quickly, like just being buyer first, people first. It seems like it continues to trend in that direction. Like, do you think that's a fair assessment over like what the data is telling us here?
I think this year the big theme was like prominence. And to your point, whether it's on a mobile device, maybe it's making sure it's front and center, and also like customizing it to what the buyer wants to see. What's really nice is when I first joined marketing, there was the very, which at the time sort of maybe made sense, but there was the very common trope of like, you can only have one CTA and you can't distract buyers. There was this idea of like, you need to put buyers down this very linear, clear path and we cannot distract them with anything else. It feels like nowadays in all parts of marketing, not just interactive demos, we've veered a lot more towards, let me give my buyers options depending on what they want. And we saw that with interactive demos. So we did see like, okay, buyers want to see the product up front. They're more often placed above the fold, in the nav bar, on multiple product pages. But also again, to the choose your own adventure, there might be one on different product pages, persona pages, use cases. It's not just, again, I'm gonna take you to this one demo and force you to go through it and go through this perfect linear function. I'm gonna give you options depending on what you might wanna explore. Or where on mobile?
People love options. We're finding a huge theme with Easy Llama, customizations. People love to customize stuff. So like, yeah, I could not agree more with that. Segment number two, before we get to that though, and you kind of give us this new fresh take on how we want to do this next segment, anything else that you think a founder, marketer listening should really pay attention to when it comes to this report and the data you guys found?
I'm actually going to answer it about reports in general. I think if you have questions about interactive demo, go read the report. The biggest thing is, I would say, don't hide the demos. Again, think about them for different users' experiences. Make them short and value-focused. We have that every year. But if you're just thinking about reports in general, let's say you say, I don't care about interactive demos at all. I think we think of reports having to be this big, scary statistical analysis, or that we have to go out and run this major survey. We started it just from looking at our own product data. And again, answering the questions our customers and prospects have. It does not have to be, you obviously want to be accurate and make sure the data is correct, but it doesn't have to be this like complex complex process. There we go. You really can just be as simple as ask your CS team, ask your sales team, what questions do you get a lot? Can we answer that with our product data? And even if you start really small, just answer 3 or 4 questions, you can build on that year over year.
That's a great point. Yeah, do not try to boil the ocean. Like just take a simple phased approach to getting like some type of report out there. That's really insightful. No, I love that. Okay, so segment number two. I'm excited about this one. I feel like it's gonna conjure up some debates, healthy debates, nothing crazy. But like, I think you're naming this, would you run this? Is that accurate?
Yep, that's what we're calling it.
Would you run this? Explain this to the audience then, please.
Okay, so when we were thinking about what a fun segment could be, I think, at least, I don't know about you, but every time I go to any sort of networking event or chat with other marketers, and I do love this conversation, but you get the conversation of like, what is your biggest growth play right now? What tactic's working really well for you? And I'm always like, I'm happy to talk about this from an inspiration standpoint, but what works for me might not work for you. And what worked for me today might not work for you tomorrow or yesterday. Like, it always depends on context. But for some reason, we just love talking about channels. So I thought it'd be fun for us sort of a little bit maybe debate or just openly talk about like, would we run this? And it's not saying never. Again, it's for this place and time, given what we know about our current companies, and to show that like, for me, it might be yes, for you, it might be no, and that's actually perfectly fine. There is no one channel that is alive or dead ever.
It's true. It's true. The classic, this is dead. Oh my God, I'm probably guilty of that for sure.
Like, I probably said it too.
It's definitely overdone at this point. Okay, so what is today's would you run this question?
Okay, so to make it really easy on us, we decided to do a very specific niche category. No, we weren't really big, but we wanted to tie it with the conversation with Anastasia. So we decided to talk about PLG. Would you run PLG? Because this is a question, honestly, after going PLG last year, after a lot of our customers kind of use interactive demos to go PLG, like, we get this question a lot. Should I go PLG? It's a big one. We might have taken on too much for the first one, but I think it'll be a fun one to debate.
Okay. So, yes. I'm just going to say every company should do PLG because there are many flavors of PLG, Natalie. Is that a fair statement, do you think?
I said that the report is every single point in the funnel, so I don't think I can talk about being specific. But yes, I do agree. I do think PLG is more of a spectrum than people give it credit for, and they just think it's like self-serve, sign up with a product with a credit card.
Yes, yes. So you got it. Going back to the point you made around people and options, like, you got to give people a taste. Our example right now at Easy Llama, the simplest way we think about PLG is we give someone a free course preview. A preview of one of the 425 plus courses you can get. We are looking to do a lot of different things with that this year, but that, in my mind, is our current flavor of PLG. And that is one of the highest converting offers to then a demo request and then also a deal being created. So there's correlation there.
I love your point, though, that it can be a flavor, because I think that's usually where the PLG conversation goes awry. It's people think it means you have to open up your entire product entirely for free. And usually that's a pretty bad strategy. Your product is probably not PLG ready if you just open it up entirely. And that, again, I mentioned, like, a lot of our customers, they'll almost use demos or video or something as that first step into going PLG. But it's more just like, I feel like you almost just need to rephrase the word rather than PLG of what is a way you can let your audience test whatever it is you offer before putting money down, which is like a pretty reasonable thing if you think about buying an expensive piece of software.
Yeah, what is the core either value or the core problem? I'll give you the example of the core problem going way back early HubSpot days. The core problem was our website was a brochure, or like our website is a brochure back in like 2008, and it's not optimized for the way people find and learn about products online back in like 2008. So what did they build back then? Something called, it was originally called actually SEO Grader, Website Grader, and it graded your website on how well is it optimized for getting found on search engines. And that was the core problem. And then, you know, that eventually led people to say, ooh, I need to solve this problem. How do I, let me talk to sales, right? So again, I think that's a flavor of PLG where you're focused on the problem versus, I think more the Easy Llama example is a little bit more about the value. Like, the value in many ways is like the actual interactive mobile friendly content we have that's very consumer grade, you know, modern, whatever, and that's what people want. So yeah, I mean, it's in that case it's a little bit of both, but I do think you could think of it, to your point, in those two maybe lenses, and that maybe helps you narrow down the scope of your first PLG initiative.
So I'm actually now going to kind of like do a counterpoint and debate myself, because I said yes to PLG, but I think your point actually made me think of scenarios where maybe you might not be ready for PLG. Not saying you shouldn't do it, but at a point in time you might not be ready. If you don't know your audience and what their pain point is, it might be hard to come up with a free offering for them. Like, I do think actually that's why I think most startups, it helps to have some sort of sales motion up front, because the sales team is really good at figuring out who is your right audience. They're very good at telling you, okay, this is a terrible fit versus one I'm excited about talking to, and then what is their pain points. And you do need those two things to figure out some sort of offer to give to that audience. So if you're still figuring out, like, what is my ICP, what is my persona, who are we going after? Not saying you shouldn't go PLG, but maybe your first step, exactly what we talk about with Anastasia, is you need to talk to your audience first and figure out what their problems are before you try to build something for them.
Great point. This idea of, like, how do you do PLG once you've at least found problem market fit versus finding, like, product market fit, and then it's trying to figure out how to scale and, like, get, like, go-to-market fit, and, you know, maybe you become a platform and you get all the way down that journey. But yeah, I think those two things, the way you just said that, is so spot on. Like, if you don't have problem market fit, what are you going to do? I mean, guess.
I mean, that's what a lot of companies do. They just put out things being like, if we just put out lead gen magnets, we'll get leads, without thinking, like, who should these leads be, or what issues are they having? Like, literally, again, we talk about this in Anastasia, but they stare at dashboards versus actually figuring out, like, what does my audience care about? How are they interacting? What are they thinking about? So I do think that's step number one. PLG can help on top of that, but you really just have to have an idea of what your problem is.
Yeah, the core problem you're solving and then the value that follows that. Let's get to the conversation with Anastasia then.
Let's do it.
All right, folks, let's go.
Well, hey, Anastasia, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm really excited about this because this happened very organically. We were just talking about this before we hit the record button. And basically, you posted a little bit about a stat from our most recent report about interactive demos. But what I loved is you brought in your expertise of like buyer knowledge and buyer experience and user psychology. I'm like, okay, not just what was interesting about this report or stat, but you brought in your own perspective of what I've seen talking to users, being an expert as far as user psychology, PLG optimization. We then got chatting a little bit on LinkedIn, went back and forth as it happens. And then I was like, hey, you referenced like, oh, you know, I do workshops, this, like, want to jump on this podcast? I didn't mention at the time that this was also going to be my first official one as co-host. So appreciate you hanging in there with us. But thank you so much for joining us and just being open to it.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you so much for having me. Well, congrats on your first episode on this podcast. I think that's exciting as well. Yeah, honestly, I don't have a lot of like good organic connections on LinkedIn, but when they happen, it's just like they hit just the right spot, I have to say. Yeah, excited to be here. And like a small intro about me. So my name is Anastasia and my real last name is impossible to pronounce because I'm Russian. So I use Kudrow and you can refer to me this way. And I've been working as a product manager, data analyst with products for the past about like, I don't know, 12 years maybe, and with growth for about like last 7 years probably. But before I was like kind of like in user experience, user research, and I have a psychology background actually. That is why like this is kind of like what brought me into the industry. I started working in startups when I was in college, and I started working with like user research, user opinions, like user psychology, all things behind that. And gradually it brought me to the product development and product growth. And right now I'm consulting on PLG and I help teams drive more free to paid conversions and like better upgrade strategies. I work with my own project Growing Pains and also work with Bess Bush and their agency Product Led.
I love that. I was going to ask, like, how did you get into this mix of PLG and user psychology? Totally makes sense. But I think this day and age of like growth hacks or there's so many advice or tips or just copying from other startups, sometimes we forget like why we're doing things because of basic user psychology. So I can't wait to dive into more of that.
Yeah, let's do that. Like, honestly, I think that like the term growth hacking absolutely destroyed every founder's psychological health. Like, I'm very much against it because somehow it made it look like doing product growth is easy. You just have to copy this. You just have to, like, I don't know, tweak this copy or change the color of the button or, you know, add a tooltip or something like this. And it will magically generate you millions of revenue within 1 year. It won't. Like, one time I remember, you know, like, Wes has a lot of great books on product led and, like, all these concepts. And one time I talked to someone, they were like, yeah, but I just read this book. I can just, like, go ahead and copy it, right? I'm like, well, good luck. What can I say? It's way more complex than it looks. And but that's why it's so exciting to work with this, you know.
So what makes it so complex and different for each company? Is it the humans? Is it because of what you're selling the product, a combination of things, other things? Like, what do you think makes it so complex? And how do you kind of like figure out where to begin?
Oh, that's a great question. Where to begin? It really depends on the team. Like, honestly, if you look at any kind of, like, I'm not a big fan of frameworks, I'll tell you that, but I have my own. But I'm not a big fan of this because honestly, I just don't believe in this silver bullet that one size fits all. Like, every team is unique. Their problems is unique. That is why, like, we always have, like, I do it myself, we do it with product led, whatever. Like, we have the audit basically to understand what the needs are. Like, I would never sign any client before actually talking to them because quite often the founders jump on the call with me and they're like, okay, we have this problem and that problem and another problem. We have like 10 problems. We don't know where to start. I start digging in and I'm like, okay, I have good news for you and bad news. First of all, you don't have 10 problems. You actually have one. Second thing is it's a big one, but it's basically like we can get like hyper-focused on that. So what makes it more complex? Honestly, it's in the naming, like product-led, it focuses on the product, you know, and every product is unique. Like, you can say that there are templated strategy. That's absolutely true. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able like to switch between the industries. Like, I work with clients from different industries all the time. Like, I don't know, a tool for architects and then a project management tool and then like a media product and then like a VPN service, like whatever. They're so different that because I do have like this kind of like core skill set and the core approach, I can kind of apply it. But why it's so complex is because whatever worked for one product, you cannot actually fully copy and just apply it, you know, as a template to another one. Like, you have to understand how the team works. You have to understand their different, like, specifics and moments. That is why I always say, like, if you, for example, hire in, like, a product manager, a growth product manager, whatever, and you really worry about them having specific experience in your specific industry, don't. Hire someone who is adaptable, who is flexible, who can learn your skill set, and who can think on the spot and find solutions to complex problems and, like, drive the team to deliverables. These are the qualities that you're looking for, not like, oh my God, I've been working in fintech for the past 10 years. Well, good luck.
I have so many follow-up questions to that, but I'm going to start with one, if that's okay, Mark. I love the fact that you said founders come with you with 10 problems and really they just have one big one. Because I think any marketer, anyone early stage can relate to that, right? Like, everyone, so easy to point out this thing's wrong, but really it's like they're not actually diagnosing the root cause. It's like, oh, I have a stuffy nose. Oh, I have a headache, versus diagnosing like I have the flu. Maybe a little more than I've had the flu. I'm so curious, what are the things that you hear most from founders that they think they do wrong? And then what is most often that, like, big thing they're actually doing wrong?
So the first thing I always hear, I love working with pricing. And for some time I've been focusing on working with pricing. That is why the first question I heard is like, are our prices too high? I'm like, hell no. Like, seriously, it's like, we live in the world where people are saving up to buy like $3,000 bags. Like, your prices are not that high. Like, seriously, it's not the problem. It's never a problem. But sometimes I see people like getting hyper-focused on that, to be honest. And another thing is, did we build enough? Like, quite often when founders don't see the conversions they would love to see and the growth they would love to see, they assume, especially technical founders, they assume it's a product. They assume it's like the capabilities of the products, like the functionality of the products. And basically their solution is, let's send everyone a huge PDF where we talk about our features and how amazing they are, and people will read it and they will like subscribe after that. I kid you not, one time, many years ago, I was working with a mobile app and we had troubles activating users, like essentially converting them to using the core feature. And when I stepped in as a product manager, I tried it and I was like, this is confusing as hell. I approached the lead developer and I said, this is confusing as hell. We need to do something about it. And he was like, oh, no. That's actually very simple. Look, I have a PDF instruction on how to use it. Let's just send it to everyone and they will figure it out. I would love for it to be just a joke, but that was it. Like, I'm not really laughing at that developer because this is the logic. It's just like a different optics, how they look at the product. But it is like quite often I see exactly this. Like, people are trying to find solutions in, we need to build more instead of we need to figure out what works already and how we can scale it, you know?
So to build off that and to go deeper into Natalie's question, for PLG to work for a B2B company, does the software have to be consumer grade? And if it does, like, how would you define consumer grade? Because I've heard this. We talked a lot about this at HubSpot early days. Yeah.
Can a normal human being start using it and understand what it does? Oh, okay. Like, three questions. First of all, I need to understand what exactly this product does. Like, what kind of result will I get, essentially? Second of all, I need to understand what will it take me to get this result. You know, essentially, am I smart enough? Like, do I have all the skill set? Like, do I need a developer on board right now? Like, do I understand how to use it? Like, for example, when like non-technical people even open the cursor for the first time, they usually like, oh my God, there is a terminal there. I don't know what's going on. That's not for me. So I need to understand that I'm able to use it without any additional training. Like, I must be able to imagine it. And the third thing, I need to understand exactly how the result look like. That is why, like, Amplitude, I love Amplitude. Amplitude, call me, please. Like, they have all these kind of, like, previews of the dashboards even before you connect it to your data. That is why they have all these templates from, like, great experts like Kyle Coyar, Elena Verna, whatever, with the dashboards that they recommend to use. Like, they're very high-level dashboards there. Like, they won't ever be enough for you. But it gives you the image of how it can look like and what kind of questions you'll be able to answer. So I need to understand, like, how the result will look like. And honestly, it's like, speaking about psychology, it is such a crucial step, like understanding how the result will look like. Because if I cannot imagine it, I won't take it to my boss. Like, I won't spend 30 minutes digging into this. If I cannot imagine like the result that I will be able to receive, that's a crucial step. Plus, when we talk about B2B, I really love Ram Lee Jong. You probably know him. His book, Eureka, And we talked to Ramli about it, like at some conference where we met, that a huge step in B2B upgrades is actually a social factor. Because basically suggesting a new software for your company, you know, you're putting yourself on the spot a little bit. You request, quite often, you request a lot of resources, not only in terms of money, but also like man hours, right? You just need to, like, hours to implement it, hours to pivot, like all this stuff. And it's a huge thing. If I cannot trust this software that the result is good enough, I won't put myself on the spot to defend it.
That's awesome. I just, like, gotta say, it reminds me of like Novatic's journey to PLG a little bit. Cause like those three things, like you guys hit it pretty well with all three with Novatic. So I'll let you take however you want to take the conversation next, Natalie. But I had to say that as a response to Anastasia, cause like the number three is super critical to my opinion. Like the example, I think what you're saying is they need to see examples that bring it to life. But yeah, I mean, Natalie, you want to build off that or do you want to go somewhere else?
No, it was so funny. I was thinking the same exact thing of, and I appreciate the compliment, Mark, but I can tell you when we first launched PLG, it was not there. We were not that level of figuring out what were those steps. And I think another thing I'd add on to this, or it fits into that framework already, was this idea of, yes, you make it clear that they can do it, and eliminating decisions. Like that was one thing that we really had to work on when we launched PLG, was initially for, obviously for a standard user, to your point, the engineers thinking, I want to give them as much flexibility as possible. Because when you're hearing feedback just from your normal customers, all they're saying is like, I have this strange use case or this use case or this use case, and they want to be able to accommodate all of them. And it took us a while to realize, no, we really had to pare down where almost the user had to make no decisions. Because the second there was a decision introduced, as they did to your point, they were like, is this for me? I don't understand these two options. It might not be for me. I'm just going to bounce. And that was one of the hardest lessons we had to learn, was like actually, and also really dividing the product. Like a good first-time user experience for a starter user, for that's what we call it, a PLG user for us, is going to be different than our normal user. And that's okay. And we have to start differentiating that, which is very obvious. But like as a product and product marketing team and growth team, like took us some time to develop that muscle.
Yeah, makes sense. But I had great experience with Novatic. Like honestly, for the first time when I tried it, I'm like, okay, like I understand how it's going on. Like I was able like to generate some interactive demo in like, I don't know, like 10 minutes or something like this, just to show it to one of the founders I used to work with, like as an idea, this is how it can look like if you want to explore it. So I think that's crucial because as a consultant, I'm usually not a decision maker. But I am the one who recommends people the solutions. So I say, like, if you don't have the product analytics, this is my recommendation. If you don't have the demo right now, this is my recommendation. But I need to present how it will look like for people to agree to explore it, you know?
And it's so funny. That was such a sneaky win for us for going PLG. And appreciate the compliment. Again, huge shout out to our product team there. They've done amazing work with the product since we first launched. But actually, one of the biggest surprises wasn't the fact that we were getting more, like, more of our ICP exactly signing up. It was a lot of the agencies and consultants who told us previously, I wouldn't necessarily recommend your product because I don't want to tell my client to go pay for something else, which totally makes sense. And to your point, you don't want to recommend a product you haven't used. Suddenly, it lets so many other people try it out, get some examples, feel comfortable recommending it because you're not saying, hey, go pay for something. And that's actually probably been one of our strongest like successes from going PLG. Also, because we found a lot of times consultants are the people posting on LinkedIn. They are the ones posting on Reddit. They are the ones building up their own social brand. So it really did just help that word of mouth flywheel. So like, if you're thinking about going PLG, I would take that into consideration. It might not be even your exact user who are the one who are trying the free plan, but it could be promoters who are then helping getting more people familiar with it.
Yeah, and plus like you kind of eliminating the headaches for consultants because, you know, like I work with teams of different scale. And like, for example, some of the, like, as I mentioned, I love Amplitude, but they're quite expensive, to be honest. Like if I have a team, I don't know, under 1 million RR, I probably wouldn't recommend Amplitude to them because I think it can get too much, especially depending on the product. If it's like usage heavy product, it can get too much, like very, very quickly, to be honest, even though I do really love them. But yeah, essentially, like I usually keep kind of like a log of the tools that I usually recommend and the log of the tools I go to. Like, for example, like I used to work with my clients and I know how much time will it take me to get the good result out of it. I know how the result will look like and all this stuff. So it does eliminate like a lot of headache for me.
So I got to ask like two things. We can unpack each separately because I think both are pretty big. And I would love to get both your perspectives on this because, you know, Natalie, you've had a lot of experience, of course, with PLG and Novatic now. This idea number one of magic moment, the aha moment, I want to like understand that a bit better. And then monetization, like getting sales involved, doing a credit card, doing both. Like that's like a can of whatever. So like, I don't know, where do you want to start, Anastasia? Magic moment, aha, or like, do you want to do monetization first?
Let's talk monetization, honestly, because, you know, I love everything that's around revenue. I'm not good when it doesn't like get anything to do with money. I need to focus on the revenue. So about the card, no card, like all this stuff. My point so far, like I'm open to debate and I think that it won't work every time. But so far, my experience tells me that if it's like B2B / B2C kind of product, for example, Miro, Canva, whatever, I would do trial with the card, hands down, for sure, trial with the card. If it's not a freemium motion, if it's like a clear trial motion or like trial within freemium, I would do trial with the card because the conversions just, you cannot beat it. I mean, they're so much better. I had it with one of the clients a couple of months ago, actually, and we switched literally to freemium plus trial with the card instead of just trial with no card. And the conversions like grew, I don't know, like very significantly, honestly. I don't remember the exact number, but it was a very good spike. If you talk about B2B, let's imagine ourselves, since we talk psychology today, let's imagine ourselves in the shoes of a person who works in the company and who wants to try a new software that they potentially can pitch and buy in the future, right? And I want to try it. I don't want to request anyone's card to, you know, to actually use it for this paid trial. I don't want to use my own card. I just want to open it, spend, I don't know, maybe 15 minutes digging around, see what I can get out of it, and later take it to my boss. So I think it is a very, very tricky question here. If you have like a pure B2B motion, depending on your buyer's motion, if like the decision makers aren't the ones who try your product in the first place, I would not do like the cart. Or maybe I would do like a freemium motion with like limited freemium motion, then with like trial with the cart. But honestly, I would just do no cart, limited time trial or like limited usage trial, and then I would let the sales like step in, because usually the B2B checks, they usually still go through sales. Like bigger B2B checks, they do go through sales. Like if you talk about self-serve and B2B, it's usually smaller projects, like something you can like easily approve, or maybe you have a small team. For example, if it's a project management tool, you have like a team of five, whatever, you can pay like $100 without negotiating it, right? But most of the time, still at some point, sales have to step in.
Yeah, it's interesting. We've seen something similar. Like I always say, our freemium motion was not necessarily like a revenue play. It was a lead play. It was get people in the door who are going to talk to sales, get us more familiar, like a wider net of people who might be would have gone with the competitor, or just done nothing if they couldn't have a free option. We chose freemium mostly because we did want to give people that chance to actually sign up, put an interactive demo on their website, test it and see results. We also have a little bit of a natural flywheel where like, anyone who builds a demo and puts it on their website, even if they never pay us, that's getting visibility for Novatic. So that's why we chose freemium over free trial. But we have heard plenty of times, people who signed up like 6 months ago, 3 months ago, tested it out, and they're slowly making their case. Like they are getting buy-in, they have to test it, they got to try it, they're making the pitch internally. And I do think if they had to put a credit card, they might have been a little less likely to do that.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely, like I know that the conversion is better, but let's be honest, why conversions are better? Like, first of all, okay, you understand like the endowment effect, the commitment bias. If I paid for something, like if you pay for the gym, you're like, okay, now I'm obligated to go at least once a week, you know, just to get those money back. But also, we are all human beings. People just forget to cancel another subscription. You know, it's not a healthy retention. Like auto renewal is not a retention strategy. But of course, the conversion is better because people just forget to cancel it after they tested it for 1 week. So I think that like if you have trial with the card, yes, the conversion will be better, but it doesn't mean that you should not put a lot of effort into activation and like feature adoption and the long-term retention. You still have to, because otherwise you will just have a huge churn after 1 month. And once people churn, it's actually way, way harder. We all know this. It's way harder to get them back. Like it's easier to get people who never paid for your product before to get them to upgrade than to get someone from churn to upgrade again. Like it's a way harder move.
Yeah, it's like phantom churn. I helped a company that sells a very simple but very high quality pair programming piece of software. So basically it's like Zoom for developers, right? Pair programming, like you code together, program together. And we did exactly this. And the first thing I recommended is like, we need to require credit card upfront and see what that does to conversion. And then also the subsequent metrics you just mentioned, Anastasia. And it helped overall across the board. The thing is, though, there's phantom churn, right? Like that creeps in. You got to watch for that. And I still think I ended up, you know, not working with them forever. And they still hadn't figured out, going back to this magic moment, this aha moment, what that was. Like, is it like when you have like at least three calls where you're pair programming together? Is it something else? Like, how do you get more team members? Because their monetization model is all about users. How do we get more users, obviously, with pair program? So, yeah, it's very dependent, I think, on the ICP. Going back to your comment on like small business, you're selling a small business, HubSpot, right? You could say 20-person business. Yeah, I'll swipe my credit card to get marketing tools that cost $200 a month versus, no, I got like a 200-person business, 2,000-person business. It's going to cost like $3,000 a month. That's a way different considered purchase. So there's definitely some like factors in play, but I would argue, with almost everything in marketing, right? You got to test it. Like, you just, I don't know. Have you tested it, Natalie? I'm just curious. Have you tested this monetization yet? Or has it been like kind of one and not too many tests going involved into the monetization yet?
We've tested like the plan and packaging, and we actually recently introduced a $50 a month plan. So we're kind of testing like more self-serve upgrades, but not credit card upfront. I think because we're freemium, we probably wouldn't do that. And again, for us, like our goal with this plan is not self-serve revenue. The goal is leads for the sales team. So we want a wider bucket up front versus like a narrow bucket if the goal is more entirely self-serve plan.
I think it makes, I really love what you said right now, because like whenever like someone asks me, okay, what is the best? You know, like ask for a card. No, don't ask for a card. I'm like, well, it depends on your strategy. You know, if you like get in real, like if you talk about startups, for example, I usually work with startups. Maybe you need to show your investors that you just have a large user base and then go freemium. Of course, like, you know, give a premium, like generous free tier, and then you can figure out the monetization. Like, why not? Because like, it really depends on what exactly you want to do other than just like following some, I don't know, some benchmarks or some frameworks that you don't really understand how to apply.
ChatGPT.
Oh gosh.
It's not this, it's that, you know?
I am curious. I want to talk a little bit about the aha moment though, because I think one thing that we've been thinking a lot about Novatic and for the PLG motion is not just like what's the aha moment, but how does it also differ from our activation moment? Like, I think we have a pretty good idea for us. The activation moment is they make a demo. Like, if you are not publishing a demo, you're seeing no value in Novatic. You have to create an interactive demo. But we realized, like, what are the moments, and this is what I think when I think aha, I think everyone has their own definitions. What's a moment that gives someone a moment of delight or much more likely to upgrade? And that for us is if they edit their product capture. So look, getting a little more specific weeds, but basically like they get to make it more personal to them. They get to see a moment that usually is frustrating, which is like your product data is messy. And now they're having a moment of delight of like, oh, I can easily clean it up. So I think we haven't done a great job. Like, we've really over-indexed on the activation moment when we thought about PLG. But I don't think we've done a good enough job thinking about the aha moment. And I'm curious, Anastasia, is that common? Like, people really think about the activation, but not like the delightful moments.
Yeah, I actually agree. Like, it's usually the activation that like gets all the attention. But honestly, I think it's also like the question of terminology. Like, quite often people use aha moment as an activation moment, like just like a synonymous, you know? I honestly, I have two thoughts here. Like, first one is that PLG in general, I think, and especially when we talk about the activation funnel, like this whole activation journey, it's only possible when you have a lot of data, like a lot of data. And you don't just have this data. It's actually a well-organized data, you know? I actually think that analytics right now, it's not such a problem, like just to, you know, add Claude MCP or whatever, and you'll be fine. You can just ask questions later. I know a lot of teams who do this, but just getting this data organized, getting like a very clear event tracking system from the beginning, this is where I see a lot of teams are struggling. Like, I did it for products like multiple times because they come to me and they're like, okay, we're getting some upgrades, but we have no idea like what is the difference between people who do upgrade and people who don't upgrade. And I'm being honest, I'm like, you know what? Without data, I can give you like my heuristic breakdown from my experience. But in general, I cannot do anything. We need to get the data first. So we're getting the data first, and then you kind of like building on top of it. But my second point is that there is this like very, you know, a very confusing thing about activation. Like, do people who, let's say, edit the capture of the project upgrade like more willingly and like easier? or they are motivated enough already. And that is why they added their capture, the name of the capture. And that is why they upgrade so easy. You know, it's always like a chicken and an egg problem. And you never know, actually. The only thing, like, that is why I think that, like, what is crucial about PLG and what a lot of teams get wrong, they have like a PLG motion and they have like a marketing motion. Like, my hands are very far away from each other right now for those who are listening to us. They must be connected, because quite often, like, the secret to upgrades hides in the channel, in the acquisition channel. If you tap in the right audience, they will be getting upgraded, like, upgrades like way easier than others. Like, some people would buy on the spot, like on the demo call with you, not because they went through all the steps, but because they have a more painful problem. It's like, you know, if you can pick one advantage while you sell them burgers, what would you pick? A hungry crowd, of course, because you're not stupid. No one cares about the souls if they're starving. This is exactly the same. And I think that this is like, sometimes people are getting like, I see teams like being obsessed about like the activation moment, the aha moment, like all this stuff, when first of all, they just don't have enough data. Like, they just don't. I'm like, I can build a dashboard for you in Amplitude, but you know, it's absolutely useless. You simply don't have enough data for segmentation. And second of all, they just like hiding behind dashboards instead of actually jumping on the calls with users. I understand that I'm beating like the dead horse here. Like, everyone kind of like, we always like talking about how it's important to talk to users, but not a lot of people actually doing it, you know? And I see like a drastic difference between founders and like teams who actually jump on calls. It doesn't have to be like a separate interview, a demo call. That's fine. Just use it to explore. It should not be like a sociological research or whatever. Use any kind of resources you can find. I don't know, do AI scraping of your mentions on Reddit. This is what I usually do for my clients, you know, any kind of insights to basically understand not like the moment of the choice, but the context of the choice. They don't buy because they updated their capture. They buy because they did something before that happened to them that made them willing enough and motivated enough to update that capture. And usually, like, in my opinion, the secret to growth like hides in this kind of combination between who we acquire, in what kind of context, and how do we fit within this context.
I mean, that's mic drop. That's like for any type of offer. It doesn't matter. It is. It's like, that's like, anyway, we should end it on that note. I don't know, Natalie, do you have anything else you want to ask? I just thought it was that. That's so good.
So good. So good. When you said the hamburger analogy, I was just like, wow, that is a quote. No, but I think you're spot on. Like, to the exact point of editing the captures, the people who do that are probably people who have listened to us talk about it on a podcast, seen an example from a customer, talked to a friend about it, and been like, oh, that's a cool thing about it. And does they probably just like magically stumble upon it and be like, wow, now I'm so convinced. So I love that point. And I think also, this is why I'm pretty pro if you can incorporate some sort of sales motion. Like, I am so glad at Nevatic, we actually did sales-led first, then added in PLG, because there were so many things that, like, if you looked at the data. So, another, I'm using a Nevatic-specific example, but basically for us, we have a Chrome extension that, like, you basically need to use to see value. And for the longest time, we're like, we need to push everyone to download the Chrome extension. That is step number one. The data shows drop-off. And then the sales team was like, oh, you know, some teams, like, need approval for that, and they don't use Chrome. Which is like, duh. But when you're so obsessed with the funnel and the metrics, you sometimes forget those obvious things. And we're like, oh yeah, we can't force everyone down. Or we gotta say maybe those people aren't good fits and be okay with it. But there are just little things like that that the sales team just knows because they jump on these calls. So I do generally encourage, if you can incorporate some level of sales led into your PLG motion, whether it is, you know, they request a demo to see additional features, or you're thinking about going PLG, but you wanna like still have the sales team involved, the insights you get from that are just so valuable.
I absolutely agree. And honestly, I don't understand this. I see this like argument sometimes that PLG versus sales-led. I'm like, there's no PLG versus sales-led. PLG basically just makes your product more user-centric. And like, this mm-hmm. is, it's not even a template, it's an approach. It's kind of like a philosophy, if you will, you know, like basically to the product development. So it will bring your sales-led motion better leads. And honestly, yes. Even like early stage, like, I know a lot of people, like, they getting obsessed about, like, designing the sales or motion, but you're getting so many insights from sales, like, at your early stage. You do not have a lot of data at this point. I remember once I talked to a founder, and she was like, yeah, we have, like, 400 users, and I'm, like, staring at the dashboards in Amplitude every day. I'm like, stop. Like, I'm sorry, just, like, stop. Because they won't tell you anything. And she was, like, acts like big corporate PM, so the dashboards is essentially where you live. And I'm like, it doesn't work on this scale. You need to reach out, talk to people, offer them $50 on Amazon certificates. I don't know, whatever, make them talk to you somehow. This is like 10 interviews at this stage will bring you more insights than just staring at the data. And I know, oh my God, one time I heard this absolutely horrible joke. I hated it, that like, what holds back sales in startups? And it's like customer development, user interviews, and like all this stuff instead of just going and doing sales. Oh my God. And you never heard of it? Okay, you guys are lucky. I think it was on Russian market. So that is why it didn't make it to the world, essentially. Thank God we'd be saved. But I'm looking sometimes at the founders who are very much against like talking to users and they're still successful. I think those are outliers. And usually one of the following things are true. They either come from this like huge experience in this specific industry where they are selling. They usually have a massive network there, or they are the customer. Like they are the portal. They're essentially building the product for themselves. So they still are embedded in this community, in this context. They're just getting it like in a different way without recognizing it, you know? And I think it's crucially important. And PLG and sales-led, like absolutely, they're not against each other. That is why when I join like a sales-led team, I always say like, I'm not here to take your job away. Yeah, I think that they should like work along each other, not against.
And I think if you hold out in PLG, the sales team will love it because it makes the product easier, to your point. And that's usually feedback they get from prospects. That's the last thing I'll say, but it's worth it. Just you got to hold on to it.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, I really love this like discussion about kind of like what comes first, like the action or intention. Because with one of my current clients, we saw that basically the conversion from in sales term from people who watch the product tour on the website is 3 times higher than the conversion just like from the website from people who didn't watch the product tour. And the founder was like, hey, should we just like make everyone watch the product tour? Should we like make it like on the first screen, like put it there, like maximize the conversion into it? I'm like, no, because it's usually like more motivated people watch this video. And then that is why they converted better, not because of the video. And he was like, oh damn, yeah, it makes sense. So, but it is difficult to catch yourself on things like that.
And that is why you need brand still, like brand marketing, invest in brand, whatever. This has been a great conversation. We're going to end it on that note. There's so much you could unpack. Where can people find you though, Anastasia? Where can people continue to get the wisdom from you directly?
LinkedIn, it's Anastasia Kudrow. I think I'm only one like this, especially with the fix your free to paid conversion in 4 weeks or whatever. I also have a newsletter. It's called Ghosted. It's on Behive. Love Behive, by the way. Amazing product. Like really recommend to watch to break them down. It's called Ghosted, but where I basically talk about user psychology and psychology behind why people ghost your product or decide to stick with it.
Wow. Okay, subscribe to that right now, Natalie. That's like a must. Anastasia, thank you so much. This has been awesome. So many good insights and just practical ways to think about this, which is, you know, not an easy thing to fully get your head around and actually understand. And the intersection you bring between the psychology and the actual tech, so fascinating. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, guys. It was a lot of fun, great conversation, and let's stay in touch.
Yeah, thank you so much. Glad the cold random LinkedIn message worked.
Yeah, absolutely. The magic.
Exactly. You know? When LinkedIn works, it does have some magic sometimes.
Yeah, just like a very small percentage, I would say. But
thanks for joining us on this episode of GTM News Desk, presented by TAC and produced in partnership with Share Your Genius. For more newsworthy GTM content, head to tacgtm.com and join our community at thegtmlibrary.com. Until next time.